It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Sometimes it seems like there are two kinds of people in the world. There are those who like other people, and there are those who could do without them. I always figured I was in the first camp, but then I went to Spain. We were in Sevilla for the winter holidays, and it was sunny and warm. There were street musicians here and there. In the early evening, everybody comes out to walk. The city becomes this giant, happy, outdoor party. And I loved it for about half an hour. People kept coming out. More and more and more people. And they were all headed in one direction. I remember we stopped somebody and said, "Where are you going?" And he just looked at us and laughed and said, "I don't know." My daughter was wearing a red coat, and I kept trying to always have a bit of her in eyesight. I struggled.
This current.
Take it.
Couldn't breathe.
Just needed to get out. So we wound our way with some difficulty back into some narrower side streets, and things did calm down. It was quieter. I could hear my breath. And when we finally got back to our apartment where we were staying, my daughter said, "See, isn't Spain amazing? Wasn't it wonderful seeing all those people out? This is why I want to live here." And my son and I looked at each other, and at the exact same moment we said, "That was hell." And that's our theme today. Hell is other people. That's actually a famous line from French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre. And it was his description, not of crowded streets, but of the human condition. In 1944, Sartre wrote a play called No Exit. It's the story of three characters who arrive in hell, expecting flames and pitchforks, but they discover that hell is nothing but a plain, ordinary room where they have to spend eternity trapped with each other. So what exactly did Sartre mean? Here's how philosopher Gregory Sadler deconstructs it in a YouTube lecture.
You know, we're often tempted to say hell is other people when other people are acting stupid or, you know, getting in our way. But Sartre has something in mind that goes deeper than that, that has to do with the human condition. On the one hand, there is this thoroughgoing individualism precisely because the flip side of the coin is no human being exists on his own. Part of the very nature of human consciousness is to be conscious of others. For Sartre, this leads to a sort of tragic condition. It's impossible for us just to be content. If we actually do feel content, it's because we're concealing from ourselves the reasons why that's the case.
You can hear more of Gregory Sadler's take on Sartre on our website at ttbook.org. But, you know, thinking about this idea of hell as other people, well, the truth is, some people are more hellish than others. For instance, the guy who cuts in line at the coffee shop, the passenger who demands special treatment and then yells at the flight attendant, people who somehow feel entitled to take advantage of others. Now, there's a word for them. I can't say it on the air, but it rhymes with glass poles. Philosopher Aaron James has an entire theory about them, complete with definitions and a formal taxonomy. He laid it out in his first book, which was called A-Holes, a Theory. And now he's back with a case in point, a new book called A-Holes, a Theory of Donald Trump. Aaron, is that really what you want to call the president of the United States?
So I definitely think I was right in thinking that he's an A-word. He definitely fit the theory, first of all. That is, he takes special advantages right and left. He violates social norms. I mean, norms that we sort of forgot were there because they're not violated. And he's sort of almost on a daily, weekly basis violating basic social expectations in this way and producing pretty thin rationalizations on the fly in a defensive way and obviously being unwilling to listen to the objections and feeling indignant and that they're unfair. So, I mean, he fits the theory perfectly, and that's just sort of by accident. It wasn't designed around him. It's just he rose up into it and he fits it. But I think there are bigger questions about, well, what kind of A word he is, how to classify him, and then why, given the kind he is, his being an A word has made him so successful. So what explains his success?
Let's take those in order. First of all, let's dig into this subcategorization.
I think the type of A-word he is, aside from being of the newer, thinner style that has a very thin sense of entitlement.
Wait, what do you mean thin sense of entitlement? He doesn't feel hugely entitled?
He feels hugely entitled, but you ask what it is, it'll change. You know, it's like, it's thin in the sense like, I'm a winner, so I'm entitled to do this thing which counts as winning. You know, I'm rich, so that's the justification. Versus an older style of A-word, you know, is doing something for the cause of civilization or the cause of advancing manifest destiny or something, a lot of more grand, or even the cause of America. That gets a little bit closer to Trump, but that's thin as well because it's just make America great. What does that mean? That's hard to say. So it's thin in the sense that there's not much of a claim that you could assess as potentially giving you justification to do something that wouldn't otherwise be acceptable. So he doesn't need much by way of a justification to be supremely confident that he's entitled to take the special advantages and be very defensive and wall out opposition.
Well, this is the big question about President Trump is, given his propensity for abrasive, insensitive speech, how do you explain his appeal and his win?
He frames everything as a domination game, as it were, as a contest for status, for victory. And to some extent, politics involves that. But it also involves a lot more. But he frames everything as this kind of win. And then he's become extremely good at, you know, winning these status contests through arguments on the fly and stuff like that. And he can successfully do it, sort of successfully top the opponent, you know, usually breaking all kinds of conversational rules, using insults, posturing, deception, lying, sometimes, or just BSing, gaslighting, destabilizing the confidence of the other person, or even just switching personas. So all of these tactics for sort of winning a social exchange, he frames everything that he's become very successful at sort of winning these exchanges, and then he does it in an entertaining way, in a way that we can relate to partly because he seems oblivious and they're sort of fascinating. You know, so he's reframed this political contest in this way and then consistently won, you know, all the way up.
I don't know if it's that people are just endlessly willing to forgive him for his gaffes or worse, but isn't it possible that some of what President Trump's detractors see as obnoxious behaviors is exactly what appeals to his supporters? I mean, the fact that he is politically incorrect, that he'll say things that establishment politicians never would.
Yeah, I really do think that's part of his appeal, the fact that he's an A-word to many of his supporters. Maybe some think, no, he's not an A-word, he's just doing the right thing. But a lot think, no, the kinds of things he's doing definitely are not normally acceptable. They're not the sort of things that's okay. But under the dire circumstances, under chaotic politics, when we have a society that's in decline, or when the idea of America is slipping away from us, and a political system that's chock full of A-words competing with each other, then what you need is a bigger, a top dog A-word.
An alpha A-word.
Alpha A-word. To bring order to the chaos, and for that, sort of breaking all the normal rules of civility and decorum and stuff like that. And so that's not justifiable necessarily, but it might be forgivable if the outcome sort of works out to be beneficial. That is, that people feel like they had a certain kind of authority within the culture, you know, to have their views prevail or be said, and that, you know, the other people who should stay on the margins, people like that who feel like their prominence in the culture is slipping away from, they feel like that order is restored sort of fairly immediately just with Trump saying things that shouldn't be said, just to show that he can say them, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a power move. It's a display of dominance and a rejection of accountability. And that's the point of it. So it's partly that it is not acceptable by the normal standards is what makes him attractive for people in affirming what they feel as their right, you know, rightful authority in place.
You know, critics have often lately been jumping to the conclusion that President Trump's supporters, the people who voted for him, must therefore also be jerks. You know, if you vote for a jerk, you must be a jerk and possibly a racist, misogynist jerk as well. Personally, I kind of think that's a fairly unsubtle and very misguided view of American voters. But what do you think?
Partly, he has created license for people who either would otherwise be A-words or jerks to sort of come out, you know, and go public, be less shameful.
You advance this idea that perhaps President Trump might be able to use some of his controversial personal qualities for the greater good. Can you unpack that idea?
Well, I think that the things that Trump's supporters, some of them anyway, hope for, I mean, in principle, could pan out. You know, there are lots of sort of bipartisan forms of legislation that are there and could be established with the right kind of leadership. He's the kind of figure that could make that kind of stuff happen. So, I mean, in principle, they're not wrong to think there's a possible outcome. But whether Trump is the man to do it, I think there's almost no evidence about his temperament and his choices to think that he really will do it. And the risks of him further destroying the fabric of democratic cooperation. I mean, he's pulling threads away on a daily basis, weekly basis. The threads get unwound. The threats that those pose to the sort of very fabric of a Republican democracy are really, really, really grave. And that's, you know, aside from things like nuclear wars, unnecessary war and stuff like that. But the fundamental thing that just has to happen, and it has to happen in the hearts and minds of just sort of each citizen, is we just have to get over the contempt that we feel for one another, people opposed to the tribe. That's attempting to understand each other, learning how to criticize but show respect, learning how not to be self-righteous, you know, and so that's the idea.
And how well do you think you're doing at that, given that you've just published a book called A-Holes, A Theory of Donald Trump?
Well, actually, I feel like in the book I bent over backwards to show respect for Trump's supporters, if only by giving the best possible intellectual justification I could for their view. As I also mentioned at the end of the book, you know, I dedicate the book to my fiancé's family, which has Trump supporters. The end of the book concludes with a dialogue with my fiancé's father, who's his Trump supporter, and the kind of dialogue we had, a respectful dialogue we had about Trump's merits. And I say the book is a letter within the family, my immediate family, and also the political family, as a way of trying to understand each other and get on the same page, closer to a kind of political comedy that would rein in the political system and advance goals that all the Americans share.
And what do you think your family's, your Trump-supporting family is going to think of your book?
Oh, they love it. Yeah. They love it. They're happy with it. Yeah. So, there's no problem there.
Aaron James. He's a philosopher and the author of A-Holes, A Theory of Donald Trump. Coming up, one of the world's leading psychologists tells us why empathy can be dangerous. Our topic this hour, hell is other people. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. If people were more empathic, the world would be a better place, don't you think? If we learned how to be more aware of, more sensitive to the suffering and pain of others, we'd be kinder and gentler. We'd treat others with more compassion. Maybe. Or maybe not. Yale psychology professor Paul Bloom recently startled a lot of people by coming out with an argument against empathy. In fact, that's the title of his new book, Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. Steve Paulson sat down with him to find out more.
Paul, this is a really counterintuitive argument you are making. It's hard to believe that anyone other than a psychopath would consider empathy to be a bad thing. Are you really advising people not to feel empathy?
I'm actually not advising that. I think empathy has its place. I think empathy is a great source of pleasure. empathy is at the root of the pleasure we get from movies and TV shows and novels. I think it could be part of intimate relationships. But I think empathy is a poor moral guide. So I am advising people that when it comes to making moral decisions or political decisions, they should not use their empathy.
Why is it a poor moral guide?
Well, empathy has different meanings. And sometimes people use the term empathy just in a broad sense to mean being a good person and being moral and doing the right thing. And I'm not against that. But there's a more focused sense of empathy that a lot of psychologists and philosophers use. And it's the sense I use the term, which is putting yourself in another person's shoes, feeling what they feel, and in particular, feeling their suffering. And this might seem like a great way to proceed, a great way to make moral decisions. But the problem is that empathy suffers from various design flaws. So for one thing, it's very biased. We naturally feel empathy for people who are from our group, people who look like us, people who are cute. And it's very hard to feel empathy for people who are from another group, who are our enemies, who are strangers. And because of that, decisions guided by empathy tend to be highly biased, often racist. A second problem is empathy is like a spotlight. It zooms you in on one person. And if there's just one person to help, it could actually do some good behavior. But in the real world, we're faced with decisions involving many, many people. And empathy is profoundly innumerate. Because it zooms you in on one over many, it often leads to just the wrong moral choices. One way I put it is, it's because of empathy, we often care more about a little girl stuck in a well than we do about crises that could affect thousands or millions of people.
Right. So we read about that one story, or there's some big media story about one person in trouble or some tragedy affecting one person. We think, oh, if we could only help that person, whereas the nameless masses are actually, I mean, there are many more of those people, but it's not the individual stories that tug at our heartstrings.
That's right. So empathy is very malleable. And there's case upon case where our concern about one person leads us to act in ways that lead to, at best, it leads us to ignore the suffering of many, many others. In some cases, it leads us to cause the suffering of many, many others. One theme I keep going on about in my book is that empathy for a suffering person is often used to spur violence. It's something Adam Smith noted 300 years ago, which is that if you feel empathy for somebody, what follows from this is often a sort of rage at the person who caused that person suffering and a desire for revenge. We see that for just about every war that we get into. The war is at least motivated, at least in part, by stories of suffering victims. We see that in a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric, which takes the form of telling moving stories about people who have been assaulted, people who have been raped, people who have lost their jobs. And the outcome of these moving stories, the outcome of all this empathy, is often hatred against minority groups.
Hmm. So you're saying there's almost a continuum emotionally between empathy and anger?
There is. And in fact, there is laboratory evidence for it. People who are highly empathic are also highly punitive. In our own laboratory, we find that people who are highly empathic are more likely to want to approve of violent reprisals when people suffer. And other laboratories find that people who are highly empathic are more prone to punish those who cause someone else's suffering.
That's fascinating, because I guess I would just assume at a kind of gut level that those people with high levels of empathy would basically be really good people. I see what you're saying about, you know, maybe this wouldn't necessarily lead them to, I don't know, give money to the right causes. But fundamentally, they would be the kind of people we'd want to be around because they're going to help us out.
You would think that, but it's interesting. There's a lot of weaknesses to being high empathy. So one is it leads you to irrational choices. Another one, these laboratory studies find that it often leads to aggression and violence. But a third problem being high empathy is if you really feel the suffering of other people, it's often very difficult to help them. And, you know, a doctor or a nurse or first responder or therapist who has very high empathy would find it difficult to do his or her job. You know, if I'm a therapist and my patient is in anguish and I feel anguish, I just feel their pain, I'm not going to be a therapist for much longer.
You're going to be exhausted. It's just going to totally
I'm going to be exhausted.
It's going to wear you out.
Nowadays, we call it burnout, which is a term developed in the 1970s. But Buddhist theologians talked about this a long time ago when they talked about the limits of what they call sentimental compassion, which was their word for empathy. And they said, this is a bad way to live. If you feel other people suffering, then helping these people will become a chore, will become miserable, and you won't be able to do it for longer. What they did then is make a distinction between empathy, as we call it now, and compassion. And they say that the right way to do it, the right way to be a good person, is to love other people, feel, want to make their lives better, but not feel their pain, to help people joyously.
So the difference between compassion and empathy is, with empathy, we're basically putting ourselves in the other person's shoes. We're trying to feel their pain. Compassion is a more general feeling of love, but less targeted at specific people?
It is. I think the crucial difference is that, you know, if you're in pain and I feel empathy, then I'm going to share some of your pain. And helping you out, approaching you, spending time with you is going to be difficult. On the flip side, if you're in pain and I just feel compassion for you, I could want to make your pain go away, but I could do it with a smile on my face. I could do it without suffering. And because of that, people who are high in compassion but low in empathy can help, can make a career, a lifetime out of helping and enjoy it, while people who are high in empathy will suffer through it.
Now, isn't there actually brain research showing that compassion and empathy engage in different parts of our brains?
There is. There's a wonderful research program by the neuroscientist Tanya Singer in collaboration with the biologist and Buddhist monk Matthew Ricard. And as part of their studies, they train people to either engage in what they call compassion meditation, or loving kindness meditation really, and empathy meditation, empathy training. And they find first that these have different neural signatures. There's some brain overlap, as there always is, but they really do light up different parts of the brain. And second, and I think more important, they have different effects. People who go through this empathy training are exhausted, they find it unpleasant, and are less likely to help. While people who go through compassion training enjoy it and are more likely to help. It's more pro-social.
So compassion training, or this whole idea of compassion, it's more energizing?
It seems to be, or at least it's less painful. You know, there's some lovely work by David DeSteno and his colleagues on mindfulness meditation. You hear all of this stuff on the health benefits of meditation. But they actually find some really nice evidence that meditation makes you kinder in all sorts of contexts. And nobody knows exactly why, but their theory of it is that it makes you kinder because it shuts down empathic responses. And so all of a sudden, dealing with people who are suffering is no longer so aversive.
That seems so counterintuitive, that being kinder shuts down empathic responses.
Since I wrote my book, and as I was thinking about it, I've heard a lot from people who are EMTs or doctors, and they tell me the same thing. They tell me that they're at their best when they can help people, but they don't feel they're suffering. And sometimes if they're too prone to empathy, they're just not as good at what they do. So first, they find it difficult and unpleasant. But second, they're not as effective at it. I mean, if I go to my therapist and I'm really anxious, what do I want from her? Well, I want her to understand me. I want her to care about me. But I don't want her to freak out herself. Then I got two problems. She'd never do her job properly. While I'm anxious, I want her to be calm. While I'm depressed, I want her to be steady. And this is true for intimate relations and helping relations. We don't necessarily want people to echo us or mirror us. We want them to respond in a way that improves our lives.
So play this out for me at a practical level. I mean, what changes if we think about doing good by deliberate reasoning rather than responding emotionally, particularly empathically?
So it involves a shift, and I think in part a cultural shift, in how we think about being a good person and doing good. A shift away from listening to our hearts and doing what feels right to actually, in some clear and rational way, looking at the consequences of our actions. And I'm not at all the first person to go here. There's a movement called effective altruism that says, look, too many people give to charities just based on whatever buzz they get, what feels right, what feels good. And it turns out a lot of this giving doesn't help at all. And in fact, there's a lot of cases where a lot of this giving paradoxically makes the world worse. So the effective altruists say, why don't you do the research or look at other people who've done the research and figure out what's the best use of your time, what's the best use of your money to making the world a better place. And in some way, I think if you really care about other people, you should put aside the occasionally satisfying buzz of empathy and instead focus more on the results and the consequences of what you do.
Has this research changed you personally in any way? I mean, do you do anything differently now because of what you've learned?
Yeah, a couple of things. To some extent, I wrote the book as an attempt at self-therapy because I'm highly empathic, or I see myself as highly empathic. And to the extent I'm empathic, that's led to sort of me not being at my best, not being at my best as a citizen, as a parent. And so I'm trying to be more rational in my charitable giving, trying to go to websites like GiveWell and determine what charitable donations make the most difference. I'm trying to engage in regular meditation because I think the evidence is pretty strong that sort of suppressing some of your irrational thoughts will help you be a better person. And so I'm trying to change my life in various ways.
You mentioned parenting as well. How has this changed the way you deal with your kids?
Well, fortunately, my kids are now old enough that they aren't so difficult to deal with. But my worst moments as a parent, it wasn't when I was indifferent. It's when I felt my kids' feelings too much. My son, for instance, could be incredibly anxious because he left his homework for the last minute. And he's a teenager. He's very upset. And my worst moments were I would get upset and I'd start to freak out with him. And my best moments were when I say, you know, okay, dude, calm down. Take a deep breath. We can work this out. Let's figure out a plan and everything. And I think the same thing holds for other relationships. When people are panicked, you don't want to panic with them. When people are depressed, you don't want to be depressed with them. So it sounds somewhat strange. You should love people. You should understand them. But this sort of bathing in their feelings makes you a worse person, not a better one.
Paul Bloom is a psychology professor at Yale University. His new book is called Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion. Steve Paulson talked with him. Do you dread going to work because your office is filled with people who are rude and who treat you badly? Colleagues who steal the credit for your ideas? Bosses who give you tight deadlines when you're already swamped? Well, if this sounds familiar, you're not alone. Our theme this hour is Hell is Other People. And one place that is increasingly true is the office. In one recent survey, 95% of respondents said America has a civility problem. And 70% think it's reached crisis proportions. Christine Porath is trying to do something about that. She is a professor at the McDonough School of Business at Georgetown University, and she's the author of Mastering Civility, a manifesto for the workplace. Her interest began with a personal experience.
I wasn't as much of a victim as much as a bystander. So after graduating from college, I thought I scored my dream job, and I worked for the largest sports management and marketing firm in the world. But once I took the job at their subsidiary, what I learned is that that particular group had a very toxic work environment. And so I saw how a narcissistic leader basically had such a negative effect on people. I saw that it not only affected the way that they did their work, they were getting even at the organization, they were taking it out on customers and clients. But I also felt really bad because people were taking it home with them. So it really was affecting people's quality of life and their mood in their personal lives as well.
What was so toxic? What was the supervisor doing?
Well, he would go off on people. So he would rant and rave, you know, began early in the morning in the gym even, you know, and he was unhappy that people were not playing his music. So it started very early, and he would demean the manager of the gym and yell at him in front of a whole group of people. And then from there, took it out on others. So he would make condescending remarks about people's performance, walking up and down the halls. It was quite rude most of the time. And so it was really pretty toxic because people picked up on that and took it out on others because it colored their moods and colored the way that they treated people throughout the day. You saw people had a little bit more edge to them after experiencing that.
Well, I guess it just goes to show all it takes is one jerk to ruin a whole workplace. So what did you do?
It set me on a path to go back to school and study. What are the effects of this? Because I felt like why weren't people paying more attention to this? It was such a reputable organization that owned this place, and I was surprised at how managers with the group were ignoring this behavior. So I felt like it was important to try to show in as objective a way as possible, what are the costs of this? Because even though I was very young and naive, I felt like it seemed that we should be doing business differently, you know, that we could do better. And particularly, it was a little depressing at that point to think about spending so much of our lives in workplaces where people were mistreated. And I think part of it was also not only my experience, but my dad had worked for very uncivil bosses over the years. And he was pretty good about not complaining about it. But I think that we felt it over the years. He actually ended up having a heart attack scare. And so it wasn't until years after that that we discussed it. But you know, I saw what it could do to people over time, literally eat away at their health and well-being. And so while at the time I thought maybe that was just an outlier, maybe that didn't happen to many people, I think once I started working, I saw that it was much more prevalent than I would have anticipated. So I wanted to try to do something about it. And my whole goal has been try to create more positive workplaces where people thrive.
What are the negative impacts incivility have in the workplace? I know you said you've studied it, so by now there are probably some statistics, you know, some numbers you can put to this.
Yeah, well, I think people certainly, the vast majority of people do not work as hard. They spend time worrying about the incident. 12% actually leave their job because of being treated rudely, which is extremely costly to organizations. But what I found in experiments is when people experience rudeness or even just witness it, they are far less likely to perform well. So they're performance goes down by over 35% on cognitive tasks.
How do you begin to figure this out?
It's interesting. We actually compare students that experience or witness being treated rudely as compared to those that do not experience that. So you try to control the conditions other than that. So they may hear a condescending remark or they may hear someone in the group treated negatively. And how does it affect them? So we'll put them through cognitive tasks. One of them is a word jumble, an anagram solving task. Another experiment that we do is we give them a brainstorming task where they come up with as many ideas for what to do with a brick as possible. So not only do we, you know, measure performance and creativity, but we also capture things like what kind of ideas do they come up with. And so one of the beauties of that task is folks that are exposed to rudeness, even if they don't experience it themselves, they come up with ideas like they want to sink a body in a river, they want to smash the experimenter's face, they want to torture someone, murder someone. So we see that it actually primes people for a lot of dysfunctional and aggressive responses, even though they may not have been the one that experienced it.
So that suggests that rudeness in the workplace is actually infectious.
It is. And again, I think it takes a hidden toll on people and can lead to dysfunctional responses. So you don't want this happening because it can lead to a lot of negativity. And I think you hit the nail on the head with the idea that it's just contagious. It spreads and people see it and they start role modeling the behavior, particularly if it comes from a leader or someone of higher power and status.
How do you suggest people even begin to figure out if they're practicing uncivil behavior at work?
So I have a civility test, a self-assessment online at christineporath.com. It's also in the book. And basically, there's 32 different behaviors that I ask people to think about. How likely are they to do these things on a regular basis? And so the whole idea of the test, the online version, gives you customized feedback about what are some behaviors that you could do that would help improve areas? We all have some weaknesses. So what should you focus on and what could you do specifically to improve? That's probably the best thing is to think about specifics.
What are the kinds of questions you ask in that test?
Are you acknowledging people? Are you saying please and thank you? Do you use email when face-to-face communication is needed? Do you take too much credit for collaborative work? Do you email or text during meetings? Do you talk down to others? Do you delay access or information? Do you spread rumors? Do you belittle others nonverbally, like roll your eyes or smirk?
And I'm guessing it's not a yes or no. You know, we're all, to a certain extent, somewhere on this sliding scale. I mean, a lot of these are behaviors we've all engaged in.
Absolutely. So, you know, I have them on a scale from never to almost always. And so for a lot of these, it might be sometimes, but there are probably some more than others that you know and have received feedback about that you're guilty of.
So tell me about one company that has really gotten it right, that's really addressed this issue of civility in the workplace and established a new kind of model.
So one of the law firms that I worked with actually came in, you know, we spent a couple hours talking about what are the consequences of rudeness and what could they be doing differently. But it was a quick exercise, actually, where we had them do breakout groups. It was mixed groups, all different folks from, you know, administrative assistants on up to the managing partners. And they literally focused on who do they want to be. So what did they want their norms to be for the office? And in a matter of a couple hours or less, they decided on 10 different norms that they wanted to consistently hold people to as far as treating people right, being on time, things like that. And what they found is that within a year or 2 years, that they had actually won Best Place to Work in Orange County. So for a law firm that oftentimes we think of those places as having pretty tough and somewhat abrasive cultures, that they, you know, were not only living these behaviors but holding people to them. And the nice part about that is once they committed to it, they were very comfortable calling people out when they didn't show up and treat people right.
Christine Porath is the author of Mastering Civility, a manifesto for the workplace. And if you want to test your own civility, you can take her online quiz. You'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, novelist T.C. Boyle talks about his novel The Terranauts. It's a story of 8 scientists living in very close quarters, a glass dome that they can't leave for 2 years, which sounds like hell. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. Imagine this. It's 1994, and you are one of 8 scientists, 4 men and 4 women, selected to be part of a grand experiment into the future of humanity. Your new home is a glass enclosure called E2, somewhere off in the wilds of the Arizona desert. Now, E2 is a prototype of a possible off-Earth colony. It's got 5 biomes: rainforest, savanna, desert, ocean, and marsh. Pretty sweet. The only catch is you have to stay in this structure for 2 whole years. This is the premise behind acclaimed novelist T.C. Boyle's new book, The Terranauts. It was inspired by the actual Biosphere 2 experiments during the 1990s, and here's Doug Gordon's conversation with him.
What was it about the Biosphere 2 project that you found so interesting that you thought it would make a good subject for your novel?
Well, as you know, Doug, since we've talked before over the years, I love to consider us as an animal species on the earth, mm-hmm. as a green writer, as an environmentalist. I love to do a kind of what-if scenario. So what would it be like to be locked inside this glass structure with, by the way, tourists looking at you, mission control overseeing your every move, having little or no privacy, and having to really become a kind of subsistence farmer? They had to grow their own food.
Yeah.
In the company of these other people whom you may love, but after a while, you know, love can only take you so far. So I wondered, what would it be like?
What are the other big challenges that your eight Terranauts face?
Sex. I didn't realize how sexy this was going to be, but four men, four women locked in for 2 years, what are they going to do in there? Food. They were essentially subsistence farmers. They had to grow everything that they produced. They had some farm animals in there, some domestic animals and so on, which they eventually ate. But to make it, the men lost something like 12% of their body weight within a month, and the women something like 8%. It was subsistence farming. They were burning more calories than they were taking in.
Good weight loss program. It's the kind of thing maybe Jenny Craig could open a Jenny Craig weight loss biome or something.
Absolutely.
You tell the story of the Terranauts through three narrators. Can you tell me a bit about the three narrators?
Yeah, sure. The first is Dawn Chapman. She's in her late 20s, and she is one of the lucky ones who was included in this experiment. They had to winnow the 16 candidates down to 8. She was one of them who made it in. The second is Ramsey Ruthorpe. He is the communications officer for the Terranauts inside the Ecosphere 2. He's early 30s. He's a wise guy. Ooh, he's a very sexy kind of guy, and he is determined that no matter what happens, they will not open that airlock. The third is Linda Ryu. She was one of the original 16, but rejected for my 2-year closure, given a promise that if she stays on as support staff outside the ecosphere, then she will be included as one of the Terranauts for Mission 3.
Mm-hmm. And this would be a good time to have you read an excerpt from the Terranauts. I was thinking of one of the Dawn Chapman excerpts. I was thinking about when they first move into E2.
Well, all right, my dear fellow. I've got a book here, and I will look at it and give it to you. So the book is in 4 sections, and the first section is pre-closure. This is when they're all vying to get in. The second section is closure year 1, the third closure year 2, and the fourth section is re-entry. This is the opening chapter of the second section. Once they have entered and been sealed inside. And this is from the point of view of the first narrator, Dawn Chapman. I don't think I've ever felt anything like it. One minute, I was outside in the world, and the next, I was a living part of E2, waving mindlessly through the glass at a sea of faces while Gyro pulled the hatch shut. It's hard to describe. I'd been through that portal countless times over the course of the past 5 months. It was our worksite, after all. And I knew the smells, sounds, and configuration of E2 as well as I knew the suburban house I'd grown up in. But this was different. I suppose I'd be lying to myself if I said the ceremony didn't have something to do with it. The band playing, cameras flashing, people cheering. And yet it wasn't that so much as the hatch clanking shut and the lever locking in place that made the emotion overwhelm me till the tears started up in my eyes. Tears of joy, yes, tears of relief, but of something else, too. Anxiety, I guess you'd have to call it. Or maybe uncertainty. Maybe that would be more accurate. This really was a new world. And now I was in it, and there was no going back. I think we all felt it. Felt it as a team. The atmosphere literally shifting around us. There was a dense green living aura to the air inside that was utterly unlike the thin, stingy air of the desert surrounding us. The minute you were inside, there it was, in your nostrils. You smelled mold, spores, damp earth, process, the ants and termites and microbes in the soil breaking things down, even as the fronds of the banana trees loomed overhead and the palms reached to the sun-shot lattice of our sky. It was air you could taste, air that went in and out of your pores as if your whole body was a pair of lungs. And over it all, the great roar of the fans and blowers of the technosphere that kept it all going, our life support kicking in and running as steadily as a heartbeat, day and night. That was what it was like inside. That was what hit you, hit me, in those first few moments of closure. And not just that, but the wildness of it, too, the unpredictability of a self-generating ecosphere, the Coquille frogs rattling away at their two-note song and the galagos hooting from the trees as if evolution were running in high gear and there was no end to what could happen here. Wow, can you believe it? It was Stevie, standing right beside me, her face so close to mine I could make out the shallow pit of a childhood scar at the corner of her mouth, an indentation there I'd never noticed before. It was a flaw, the only flaw in that perfect face, and it humanized her, gave her character. Stevie, the real-world person who was capable of suffering and hurt just like anybody else. She'd turned to me, still waving to the glassed-out crowd, her eyes in soft focus. Can you? No. It's incredible, isn't it?
Thank you, TC. That was great.
You're welcome.
I found it very interesting that the Jeremiah Reed character, God the Creator, alias GC, has the 8 Terranauts inside E2 perform plays every so often. Why does he do this?
This is based on the true history, by the way. John Allen had been a theatrical guy and, like my character, had been in Broadway plays. He felt in team bonding, it was very important that they should perform plays together. And so I've chosen 3 plays throughout this novel that they perform as a team bonding exercise. And of course, in the larger view, there is a theatricality to what they did. In the original Biosphere, was it really science? Well, science posits a theory, and then you do experiments to see if that theory is correct. Well, they didn't do that. They did something like, with tremendous chutzpah, you know, let's create a world. Let's put on a show, kids. Let's go inside. Let's see what happens. And I think that is valid.
Sure.
One thing that fascinates me, Doug, is what if there were 10 friendly billionaires and they'd built 10 of these things a mile apart in the Arizona desert? Each one, if it had gone 100 years, would have been a radically different world with different evolution of the creatures inside. It would have been quite fascinating as an experiment. So I think there is validity to what they were doing, but it's not strictly science. And of course, to attract attention, and they did attract enormous attention,
yeah,
the theatricality did not hurt.
Yeah. And one of the plays, as you mentioned, GC, the God the Creator, the Jeremiah Reed character, picks 3 plays for them to perform. And one of the ones that he chooses is Jean-Paul Sartre's classic, No Exit. Why did you choose this one?
Well, it's fairly obvious, I think. And I use an epigraph from it for the quote, "Yeah, hell is other people."
Yeah.
I'm wondering if that is true as a proposition. And so it seemed natural that the 3rd play, when they are all having a lot of inner tension, would be No Exit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sure seems to be true. The fact that what goes on, without giving stuff away, it does seem true that hell is other people to a certain extent. And that line reminds me of something that the great British science fiction writer J.G. Ballard once said. When you work in an office, you have to suppress the biological urge to kill everyone around you. And I'd say that this very same biological urge also can apply to working in a biodome. Don't you think?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
I love the quote. Thank you for that.
Yeah. I want to run this theory by you. I think that the Terranauts, in a way, could be seen as a prequel to your 2000 novel, A Friend of the Earth, because A Friend of the Earth is set in the year 2025, and as a result of our destruction of the environment, the climate has changed and biodiversity no longer exists. You said at that time when that novel came out that that novel addresses the essential question of ecology. Do we have the right to use the Earth for our own purposes, and what are the natural consequences of living as if we have dominion here? I'd say that those same questions are at the heart of the Terranauts. What do you think?
Yeah, very much so. That's a great observation. I am coming to you from a place where we are in the 5th year of our drought. I live in Santa Barbara. Mm-hmm. We are on a mandatory water restriction of 30%. And of course, as an ecologist, I was using the minimum to begin with, so it makes it difficult. Climate change has come much more rapidly than we could ever dream of. We all turned on our showers 10 years ago thinking, well, you know, so our grandchildren have to wash in sand like birds. What do we care? It's here already. And by the way, it has been very difficult on my wife and me because we're only able to bathe once a month, and we do this together in the bathtub so that we can then use what's left over to water the plants and, of course, then boil the spaghetti.
Wow. Only once a month?
Yep, that's it.
Wow.
By the way, I'm joking, and I
just turned. Okay, I fell for it. Back in 2003, you said that we are all imminently doomed, and you asked the question, what is exactly the point of being here in the first place? 13 years later, have you come to any conclusions about the meaning of life? Are you any closer to finding it out?
Another great question. So I'm writing about the ecosphere, and I wrote about the removal of invasive species on Santa Cruz Island and the aforementioned book about global warming. I'm playing with the idea of what we are doing here. We are animals, but we're not animals in another sense, too, in that we have a spirituality. We have a brain that is not quantifiable, really. What does it mean? Why are we doing this? Why are we here? Of course, those are the ultimate questions that we all ask throughout our lives. I have no answer. My only solace is in nature. I love to be in nature as an animal in nature, which is why I call myself an environmentalist, simply because I like to be alone in nature. And prior to going on this tour, I spent the most of the last 2 months up in the Sierras at 7,200 feet out in the Sequoia National Forest. And every day when I was done with work, I would go deep into the woods by myself. Yes, I'd bring a book and contemplate things, but it's so essential to me to have this, to feel some bigger thing, to be an animal attached to animal existence, when most of the time we're so detached from it. We're so obsessed with our devices and our machines and artificial reality. In fact, of gaming and games, I've said, you know, it's a good thing we have virtual reality because real reality is on its way out. So I don't have any good news. I'm still just contemplating things and creating stories. I create stories in the way that one of my close friends, Pablo Campos, the painter, makes paintings. It's what we do. It's our way of creating something which stands against the negativity and the depression of having no purpose in life. We all want to have a purpose, but really, we have to create our own.
Yeah. Yeah, and you've certainly done that for our enjoyment and edification. Do you think that you could last 2 years in a biodome?
Great question. I couldn't last 5 minutes in a biodome. I would kill and eat everybody within a week. No way. I need space. I need to roam. I need to be outside. This would have been very difficult for me. Yes, I lead a very public life. I love to talk with you on the radio. I like to be on TV. I don't mind that. I love to be on stage to turn people on. But there's also an introverted side of me, and that's when I'm writing and when I'm out in that woods by myself. I need it so desperately. And I'm lucky to be able to have both the company of my fellow humans and also their absence.
That's the writer T.C. Boyle. His new novel is called The Terranauts, and that was Doug Gordon talking with him. And that's it for this hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced this hour with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Raymond Tangakar, and Mark Rickers. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Our technical director is Joe Hartke. Steve Paulson is our executive producer, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.